on Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for taking your time to be with us tonight, right here before Christmas. We have a really special guest tonight. It's quite unique for my show, because you know on my show I usually talk about science and medicine. And tonight we're going to talk about delving into the soul from a poetic perspective, and we have presidential inaugural poet Richard Blanco. Welcome, Richard, and thank you so much, because I know your schedule is like a mad race, and I thank you so much for taking the time to come on with us.
My pleasure, Eva.
So before we get started, tell us a little bit about you as where people can find you, the name of your new book, and any other books you have if you'd like, but mainly where they can find you and read about who you are and what you're doing.
Well, I have three books of poetry, obviously, from before the inauguration. Wasn't just a whim. I've been writing for 20 years. But we're very excited because we just redid the website, which has a lot of wonderful information. And that's richard-blanco.com. And in there you'll find sort of the whole archive of everything that's happened since the inauguration and a lot of great information, including some highlights of some of the great things that poetry is doing in America. So, that's a great place to start.
Your website looks beautiful, by the way. I just love it. It looks great.
Yeah, we're really excited about it. It's the website come true kind of thing, dream come true kind of thing.
Well, we're going to do a little bit different interview tonight with you because I know most people, you know, what they want to know, what'd you do when you get the phone call, how'd you get picked. But I know that information's all over the place. So I want to know, who is Richard? Because when I read your book, and I have to tell you this, I've known you for a really long time, but I didn't know you, really, you know. And when I read this book, and I told you the story today, for the first time since I was in the second grade, and I specifically remember this, I didn't remember what I had on that day, in the second grade at Thanksgiving, and the reason I make that analogy is because your beautiful analogy about Thanksgiving and your life as a child, I was proud to be an American. So please, if you would tell us the name of your new book again, and then talk about, first of all, how you came to do that book. What happened in your life that pushed you to knowing that that stuff was inside you?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the name of the new book is called For All of Us, One Today, An Inaugural Poet's Journey. And there were several reasons I wrote that book. One is this idea of the impulse of the writer, as Anaïs Nin said, that, you know, writers taste life twice. And just the whole thing still seems dreamlike to me, so I wanted to make sure it happened in some way. But the other real big important piece of it was to document the emotional journey and the spiritual journey of what that whole experience was, and still is. Creativity, the arts, writing a poem, you know, painting a painting, dancing a dance, you know, these are things that are very, you know, they're craft, they're things that we learn, they're things that we study, they're things that we perfect, but they're also a very spiritual and emotional journey into the deepest parts of yourself. Whether that means writing one poem or writing a book of poems or whatnot. So, you know, I wanted to write that book because there were details that, you know, didn't come out, as you were saying, in any interview. You know, it was kind of like some of the same questions, and that's fine and dandy, and that's all great, too, and people want to know that stuff, and it's important. But I wanted a place to document the emotional and spiritual journey as well as a creative journey. So that's what that book is certainly all about. It was a place for me to, download, you know, and just really understand, to share with everybody what writing that poem really meant for me, beyond the actual craft of crafting the poem.
When I first heard about your book, and I was told it was a book of poetry, and I hate to admit this because it reflects my ignorance here, but I thought I was going to get a book with a bunch of rhyming words. It's not that. It's the most beautiful colloquy of words I have put the way you put them together I've ever read in my life. Where they come from? I mean, tell me, Richard, what do you believe? And here's two questions in this one. And I don't mean the skimming of the water answers. I mean, a couple levels of deep down and underneath the water. What do you believe the source of your intention comes from writing this book? And from where do you believe the creativity comes from?
Well, I think most artists and most creative spirits always come from a place of I don't want to say darkness is not the right word, but a certain sort of a spiritual challenge that we all have in our lives. For me in particular, it was my grandmother who was very verbally abusive and very homophobic. And ironically, you know, throughout the years, I've learned to understand and contextualize what that meant in my life. And I realized that in some ways she was responsible for me being a writer. In some ways she made me an observer of the world and a careful study of human nature and of human behavior, because I had to take a step back and become an observer of the world versus a participant. So she's been my muse in many ways. I mean, this is, of course, after years of spiritual, you know, sort of work and of trying to understand myself and my motives and why I do what I do and why I was drawn to poetry or the arts in general. So I think that that's a big part of it. I think that that's where a lot of my poetry comes from. And also, you know, I got to tell you, you know, there's something that's been coming up lately and since the inauguration, and it's something that I try to touch on the book. But the idea of poetry as a healing element, you know, is very important. Something that I didn't realize I was doing, but I'm getting this feedback lately of like how people's lives have been changed and feel suddenly, you know, are connecting with family members through this poem or through some of my poetry that they've picked up, or are suddenly having revelations about their own life and healing wounds. And I think that's part of why I was drawn to poetry, in a way to heal myself, in a way. And I think there's a therapeutic element to the arts and to poetry that we don't always acknowledge. We don't always acknowledge in a classroom or in a workshop setting. But I certainly think it's a big, big driving force between why we're drawn to, you know, again, paint a painting or become a dancer or write a poem or become a musician. There's something really interestingly sort of almost selfish that we want to want to understand something else about ourselves. I think what's unique about an artist is that at the same time we also recognize that our stories, we offer up our lives. We offer up our examples and our experiences as almost archetypes or as an example of perhaps that transcends the very story that we're telling, as a way to maybe make it through some of these elements. And I think that comes through in between the lines, as they say in poetry. You know, the idea, one of the inaugural poem, for example, throughout the months later that I've been reading it, I realized how much of a really personal poem that was. And yet I also understood as an artist that I had to give something to the people that read it. In other words, that artists are in some ways channels, that they're in some ways healers, that they're in some ways of service in some ways, because they understand that their lives, their honesty and their ability to be honest in their work opens up doors in other people's hearts and souls to sort of look at their own lives and sort of connect in ways that perhaps they hadn't connected. And I think that's the ultimate magic of art. You know, we can, you know, many people and many academics and many, you know, books and criticism will dive into other areas of what a poem means or this or that. But at the end of the day, a poem has a visceral, emotional response that even though we may not understand it completely, there's a beauty of it that comes through sometimes. And not in every poem and not in every poet, and I want to sort of contextualize that too, because it's just like music. You know, you like some kind of music and some other music doesn't reach your heart or your soul in the same way that perhaps jazz might, but for some people it's punk rock, whatever it is. There's a plethora of sort of artists and writers and poets sort of touching in many different nerves. And I think that's ultimately the beauty of why I think that keeps me going and keeps me writing. So it's this weird irony of being this weird irony of art, of being like sort of completely selfish and self-indulgent and like, I want to write this poem, or I want to dive into this aspect of my life. But at the same time, you also realize that you're doing that because in some ways, at the end of the day, it's going to help somebody else understand their own lives or contextualize something else in their lives, in their relationships, in their memories, and whatever it is that they hold in their hearts and in their deepest recesses of their soul.
You know, when I hung up the phone with you earlier today, something a phrase came to my mind that I see when I hear you and when I look at you. You seem to bring some disorder to the order, and I mean that because you were in this world of engineers and conventional classical kind of things. But you brought into them some very disorganized things into that very ordered world to help teach people how to take that first step out onto the ice. You were an immigrant, or your family were immigrants. You were gay.
Yes.
You were an engineer. How did you come out of that conventional world and have the strength to do all of those first things?
I'd like to take more credit than than happened, but sometimes our lives are I wouldn't say fated because that's a strong word, but that we're paying it. At least I was paying attention, I should say. But part of it has to do with just the very simple fact that I was an immigrant, as you said, and that the life of the idea of a life in the arts was just really outside of sort of a realm of possibility because it wasn't a reality and sort of we didn't talk about art around the dinner table. But I think there's always a guiding spirit that tells you something is happening, right? Like there's something's going to happen. You know, you're going to do something that's going to be weird and different and wonderful and joyful and fantastic. And it might be just to be enjoyed by yourself. It doesn't even have to be as grand scale as being an inaugural poet. And I think what happened to me after a while, after I sort of had done and studied engineering, and by the way, I'm also a left brain, right brain person, so it wasn't like something I was forced into. It was just something that I had a unique curiosity about math as much as I did about poetry. But of course, our society and our families in general tend to support these sort of more traditional roles. But it wasn't until after like maybe my mid-20s, I didn't start writing till I was much older. And I'm glad I did, because I think I had a maturity and a certain perspective that helped me to move forward in poetry in a very different way. And what happened is I just sort of gave that gift to myself. That finally, that dawning of just opening up and saying, you know, I'm going to allow myself to do this now. You know, I've done the other stuff. I've done what my family sort of understood as real. I've done what, you know, society understands as sort of more legitimate, or I could say, or accepts more as a traditionally. And I was just doing it for fun. And it was just like this joyous spirit of the soul, you know. And I can't help but think that part of my success throughout the years has been that I've always approached it with fun and with just sort of pure delight and joy, and not with so much expectation, but rather I was just doing it to enjoy it. And that's when I started writing, and I didn't really have any expectations out of it. And then there was the dark night of the soul, of course, that came after my initial success with my first book. And we can talk about that a little bit, but certainly I think that's how I made a change. But then again, you know, I see knowledge as knowledge, like you were saying about science and that your show and how we concentrate, how perhaps you're concentrated on sort of other things. But at the end of the day, we're all artists in some way. We're all paying attention, you know, the Einsteins of the world to like, there's always this, I feel we're all artists no matter what career we choose. And if you really accept that, you're going to excel in whatever you do, because the idea of being a creative spirit really just doesn't apply just to artists. It applies to many fields. It applies to just paying attention to the world, to synthesizing knowledge to your sort of to come up with something new and exciting and a new solution and a new boundary to break, a new sort of edge to push. So I think that's where I've always sort of felt comfortable. And most people don't know that I'm still a practicing engineer. I've never really given it up. I mean, I haven't done much this last year, obviously, since the inauguration. I've been quite busy, but I love that part of me, and I see it integrated into who I am, and it's part of what makes me a great poet. Is I think my engineering, and part of what makes me a good engineer is also my poetry. I've always said that one helps the other.
So speaking of engineers and math and dark nights of the soul, you know, I've interviewed some of the most respected engineers in the world, like, you know, Bill Tiller, Bob John. And one thing I've found is every single one of them has had troubles with their peers thinking they're heretics and had dark nights of the soul. And because of those things, they all tell me that it made them to be better people. It made them understand the oneness of humanity and that there's some higher or some influence of higher power, regardless of what you want to call that thing.
So right, right.
I'd love for you to talk about Dark Night of the Soul and higher power and pain and how to come through it and what it did for you and, you know, what you came away knowing about humanity. If you don't mind.
You know, it was, like I mentioned, like when I first started writing, I was just sort of doing it out of the pure joy spirit, out of this pure sort of childhood, spirit and energy of just pure creative curiosity and exploration and having fun. And so I had, you know, by no fault of my own, I had great success, and I had my first book published before I even graduated from my master's program. And then the second book was blood, sweat, and tears, because suddenly I froze. I froze in fear. I froze in apprehension. I froze in feeling. The ego really started setting in. It was like, okay, Richard, now you've published this wonderful first book that was awarded this prize, and now you're a professor of poetry, and you should know how to do this stuff, and you don't need anybody, and you're like, you know how to write a poem now. Like, that's it. You're done. You know, you should know how to do all this stuff. And I really got really insulated and just kind of like white-knuckling everything and became, my soul withered and the poetry withered. And it took me, you know, as I always like to say, my first book I wrote at lunch hour. My second book was night and day for 5 years until I abandoned the whole project and then wrote the book in 5 months once I let go of all that kind of apprehension, and I was able to go back to that space. And that was a really dark period, because I remember I said to myself, if this is what it's going to be like, I'm not going to write anymore. And if you really have time for anecdotes, I mean, I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I have a poem in the third book about I set the whole manuscript on fire, and then it started raining, and the poems wouldn't burn. And so I had this sort of revelation of the idea that you're as an artist, there's a calling, there's something deeper that you need to recognize, that you can't do away with your poems. Your poems are stronger than you. And that was
Can I ask you a philosophical question here?
What's that?
Do you mind if I ask you a philosophical question?
Sure.
After going through all of that, do you believe, this is kind of a trick question, but I don't mean it to be a trick question. Do you believe that we have complete free will, and the trick part of it is complete? Can you talk about free will?
Oh,
do you have an opinion on that?
Do we have free will? I think we have an obligation to investigate our lives, and I think that's where free will comes in. I think we can choose to not. We can choose to go through our lives through zombies as zombies and not pay attention and not challenge ourselves and not ask those questions that need to be asked and give up or not even try in some cases. And I think for me, that's what free will really means. It's the ability to actually to have the wherewithal to make those choices, to move forward, to feel incredible pain, even if that means, but to also like feel incredible new emotions and incredible new parts of ourselves that we never did. And I think that at the end of the day, regardless whether you go through the dark night of the soul, and I think it's inevitable in every archetype and every story, I think every artist goes through that moment because we're pushing ourselves. We're saying, you know, we're not comfortable here. We need to investigate more. And I think that's where free will, I really think, comes in. It's this moment of we can sit back and watch the world go by, or we can choose to participate and to become part of the very, I don't know how I could say it, part of the very fabric of life and join that flow and that energy. And sometimes that's difficult, and sometimes that's, speaking of the dark night of the soul, I mean, I think it goes back to St. John of the Cross or St. Teresa, I'm not sure, one of the two. But that sense of, you know, like, of, we don't, it's easier not to go there, but once you go there, you know, at the end of that crossing, there's this whole other world. And I think we might have many dark nights of the soul. I mean, I think, to be honest with you, Eva, like, now that this whole experience is happening with me, with it being an inaugural poet, it's opened up a whole new set of challenges, a whole new set of wonderful, wonderful experiences, but also challenges that I'm going to have to face. And I think I thank my first dark night of the soul for what I think might be another one, maybe not as bad, hopefully, but the idea that as long as we challenge ourselves, I think that's what free will is, the ability to say, I can challenge myself and I can challenge the world and I can challenge myself and the world to think differently or to think, to push to that leading edge a little bit more.
Now that you've had a dark night of the soul, And let me just go here and talk about quantum mechanics for a minute, because I know that's a topic that probably interests you too. You know, energy doesn't stop, it just changes forms. If you're in a swing hanging from an oak tree, however high you go forwards, you're absolutely going to come back the opposite direction to the same degree, right?
Right.
Mass. So what did you learn from that dark night of the soul? When you have another one, because it's kind of guaranteed that if you live life with passion and you swing up, you're going to swing back. Then you're going to swing up again. What did you learn from that dark night of the soul that next time it cannot be quite so deep?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, I mean, you're making me think as I speak. So, but, you know, interesting enough, just before all this inaugural stuff happened, I wasn't quite dark night of the soul, but I had relaxed into sort of a really wonderful balanced space. And I said, Richard, although I call myself Rick, not Richard, when I speak to myself, you know, this is your legacy. Be okay with it. Let it be what it is. Enjoy it. Enjoy your work. Enjoy your friends. Enjoy the beauty that your work can bring to the world, and be fine with that. And I think that kept the pendulum from, as you're saying, like, from swinging too much to the other side or one or the other. The idea of just sort of keeping that balance spiritually and emotionally that says, at the end of the day, it's really all about what you put into your work, and that's the only thing that really matters. At the end of the day, everything else sort of is just stuff that happens around it. And if you pay too much attention to it, or if you start believing too much of it, it can lead to trouble, because then the pendulum starts climbing up one end, and then the backswing is is what it is. So, you know, I think we live our lives, of course, we can't always keep the pendulum right in the middle, because that's also stagnant. But I think I've learned to sort of be happy in that balanced space that says, that where I don't have to lose myself and yet enjoy those moments of what I am and what I'm doing and its effect on the world and on my readers and on people in general that can appreciate poetry. And so I think that's what I really learned from that dark night. So it's like, to put it very colloquially, like, don't take yourself too seriously. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. it's you know, I keep on saying to my partner, Mark, you know, every day is a grounding ride for me. It's like, you know what, if I have to just go back to walking the dog in my little town in Bethel, Maine, I will have had such amazing experiences to take to the grave with me that are so satisfying already. And so the idea of just letting that go and not you know, not trying to make more of what is already great and not trying to make less of it either, but just accepting it and flowing with it and understanding. And I think what also helps, now that I'm thinking out loud, is to find a greater purpose to what you're doing. And the inauguration certainly taught me that, and the idea that there's something larger than yourself, so that it's not about the pendulum, it's not about your sort of little personal pendulum swinging, but I think it's more about the idea that you're a vehicle, you're a person of service, you're someone who is giving, you're someone who is a channel. And I think that helps to understand that there's something larger going on than just yourself or your work, but that, excuse me, that helps to keep you grounded, to understand that when you read a letter from someone or from a third grader or something like that, that there's something going on that's just not really your ego, or your great talent or your amazingness as a poet, but rather that there's something larger at work in the universe. There's some larger law going on of which you are just sort of a part of. And I think that helps the pendulum from feeling this swing, right? I think the swing comes when your ego gets really involved and you're like, well, I'm going to do this. And, you know, hey, I met Beyonce, you know.
You know what?
that kind of thinking.
You don't know this, but I have some great entertainment that's going on right now with what you're saying. You are so intuitive. Quantum entanglement is really playing a huge role right now, because you'll be talking, and I'll start thinking of, okay, I want to take this thought and go here with it. And I'm not saying a word, I'm just sitting here, but you automatically lead up and open the door almost as if we planned every single sentence that you're saying. You're going to see what I mean when I ask this next question. And I'm going to ask you three questions, because we're already halfway into the show, and I got three things that I want to make sure that we cover before we hang up the phone.
Sure.
This first one is, I was just about to ask you, what role have you learned that integrity plays? Because you're not just Richard Blanco anymore, the engineer, you know, down there drawing plans in Miami or Maine, wherever it is that you are, you know,
working.
You're Richard Blanco, the inaugural poet. And when you walk down the street and go into the grocery store or the drugstore or sit in traffic when somebody has road rage on you, people are looking at you and they know who you are, and you have no idea that they know who you are. So you have to act a certain way, or else people's going to go away if you act ugly and say, oh, my God, that guy's supposed to be somebody that I'm respecting.
Right.
You know, how has that affected your life? Or do you even think about that? And I'm sure you do. The second thing I want to ask you, and if you can remember all this, is Mark. You know, your partner, Mark, is one of my dearest friends. That's how I come to know you. And I know, because I know him, that Mark has been one of the biggest advocates in the world on alternative medicine or holistic, you know, nutritional medicine. I'd like for you to talk about that a little bit, and just since we have this opportunity, raise a little bit of awareness about what Mark does, if you don't mind.
Because
he's an amazing person, too.
I often thank my stars, so to speak, because Mark is just, and as I was saying before, I think, you know, we're all artists in our fields if we're really paying attention to the world and the spirit and the consciousness of what exists around us. And Mark is certainly one of those people. Mark is a sort of a classically trained, you know, scientist, Harvard postdoctoral, and his journey has been just as amazing. His journey has been as maybe even more complicated than mine. And so I've always admired him for his ability to sort of always follow an inner spirit and an inner creative spirit as well, to always address issues of healthcare and issues of I don't want to say nutraceuticals, but the idea of how we heal ourselves. He's a healer as well in another way. He's always challenging himself. And I think his work is just amazing. And he's been the perfect partner in that sense, because he's an artist, but in a different field. And so it doesn't lead to conflict, but it leads to this great sort of complement to each other. So, and I help him a lot too. I can take a step back forward and see what he's doing and sort of give him feedback. He's my first reader in all my poems. He was very influential in the inaugural poem and, it, and its outcome. And I think the work he does is just really sort of, again, another type of healer. I mean, I think he's looking at frontiers of how we can think differently in science. And I mean, we can get into it because I know a lot about his job, and I've worked with him actually. Just technically, I've worked with him as well in his offices and stuff. So I know a lot of the knit and grit, but I don't think we want to get into necessarily that. But he's a person who's trying to look at things a different way, how we heal our bodies physically. And I think he calls me an emotional surgeon, and I call him sort of a physical surgeon in a way. That's the same way he works on the physiology, and I work on the mind. But we are always in the same way. We're still working on the same thing: is how to push ourselves and how to push a new sense of understanding of what science can be and what poetry can be in America, what words can be, how we can heal ourselves. Again, as I said, there's a very sort of, in some ways, a very sort of interesting sort of, self-indulgent part of the art, but then there's this also great realm of this complete sort of selflessness and the idea of service. Mark has been a person, since I've known him, that has always seen the greater good that can happen in medicine and in healthcare, and his work just, you know, let me put it this way: as a poet, I can never be with anybody that I don't respect 150,000%. And I respect Mark not only as a smart, intelligent individual, but also in what his work is as a scientist. He's taken many, many, many chances, and has left behind many things just for the sake of pushing and moving forward what it means, what our healthcare can mean and what our bodies mean, and the whole idea of mind and body connection. He's just really, really done amazing work.
And he's amazing.
I think the stars for him in my life.
So I want you to talk about the integrity thing, and then the last thing is we've got about 20 minutes or 23 minutes. I wouldn't mind you reciting a verse or two just so people can hear you. And I don't care what you recite. You can pick your favorite, but it moves me so.
Sure.
So anytime you're ready, just before we get through. So
from perhaps the inaugural poem or anything?
Whatever you want to, I don't care. Whichever. And you don't have to do it now. You can wait till we get through if you want. But just something. Let them just hear how it is that you write and think.
I'll pull it out now, and then we can keep on talking. But I'd love to read part of a poem from the latest book, which is the latest book of poetry, which is one of my favorite poems so far, which is the title poem of the book.
Okay.
But maybe we'll close with that. Yeah.
That would be beautiful. So talk about the way that your influence on people and how that's changed your... Has it changed the way you live?
Has it changed the way I live?
Yeah. I mean, let me put it this way. I'm not as certainly on the celebrity status as you are, but people know who I am that I don't know me. And I've caught myself, you know, like being in traffic or getting mad in a store before, and then somebody will walk up and go, "Hey, aren't you Eva Hearn?" I go, "Oh, my God, I feel like an idiot," you know? And so it brings with it notoriety, a responsibility to humanity. So that's what I'm looking for. You know, what is your perspective? What do you have to say to other celebrities about what it is they do with their lives?
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting. I mean, it's something that I'm going through right now. And certainly as writers, I mean, the idea of celebrity is still sort of relatively obscure. and certainly I've gained a new appreciation, I should say that first, that I've gained a new sort of appreciation for people that are really in the limelight. You know, people like a Carol King or a James Taylor, and how their ability to maintain that sense of integrity and message and to stay spot on in who they are and what they want to say to the world. It's something I'm still working through, I think, especially for a poet, because it's like night and day. Most poets, even poets who are relatively successful as I was relatively successful even before this. We usually write in relative obscurity. And so it is a new responsibility when someone comes up to you, like it's happened to me in parking lots, and just a woman will come up to me and hug me and start crying, and you're not really equipped to say and what to do or say exactly, other than just hold them, because something about that poem or something about another poem of mine, whether it was the inauguration poem or not, there's certain other responsibility. And so I'm not, I'm still managing my way through that, but I'm trying to integrate. I think as artists, and maybe that's just me personally, but there's always been sort of that home, like, as you were saying, I'm sort of someone else at home, and Mark will complain about this very much. It was like always anxious and nervous about this, and are the dishes washed, and like, and this and that and the other, and is the cat been fed, and like all these other mundane things that are just like that I'm overcompensating for somehow and trying to control my life in some ways. And what I'm trying to find out through these last few months is, how can I say, Eva? It's almost like again the Dark Knight of the Soul, or Saint John, I think it was, that said something of this nature. Like you're given this task now, this blessing, and this idea of this charge. That's the perfect word. This charge. And I'm trying to integrate who Richard Blanco is in those small moments at home, in those small moments when someone cuts you off at traffic, and who I'm supposed to be, not who I'm supposed to be, but who I'm always wanted to be. And this opportunity has always given me, this whole door that has opened has given me the opportunity to be who I've always wanted to be, who I think I was always in my heart and my soul. But the behavior certainly has to go through an adaptation phase. So, I'm actually right here right now, and actually in New York City, and Mark is, it's just an anger. Mark's surprised at me how calmly I'm taking everything, because it's in the middle of, I mean, you can imagine the madness in New York on December 22nd, how crazy it is, and the crowds and the people and the pushing and the shoving and I'm just trying to integrate. And I think for me, the challenge now is that integration, as you were saying, like, how can I be one person all the time and yet be honest with myself too, and understand that it's okay to get angry every once in a while, and that it's okay to get frustrated, and it's okay to do that, but that the core of you is somehow finding a really strong sort of center. That before I was a little split, and this is challenging me to sort of unite those parts of me. Before, like I said, as a relatively obscure poet, as all of us are in general, we get by with a lot of things. But it's so funny. I love your anecdote about like being in the grocery store and sometimes I do have to think about that. I'm like, Richard, like you can't. You have to behave, not have to, but like it's a matter of
You try to walk a conscious path, Richard.
And finally accepting that really wholeheartedly, that this is who you are. This poem is not something you just wrote, but it really comes from the deepest recesses of your soul, which is who you are, and it's okay to act that way. You don't have to always go for the default, angry face or the frustration or the whatnot, which... But then again, be easy
I'm not
on
saying
yourself
it's not
too. It takes a little while, and I think that's what makes a lot of our wonderful thought leaders in society is that I think they get that, they finally have an integration process, and they get that opportunity and that challenge to do that. Certainly, thinking about Eckhart Tolle and Marianne Williamson and all the rest of people that I've admired all my life. How they can perhaps integrate that in a way that's more consistent. And not that we don't mess up. It's okay to mess up too,
I know you try to walk a conscious path. I know that. That's what I was asking. Do you think that's an important thing for other celebrities to stop and think about, since they have
certainly.
Such an influence in the world?
You know what I realized, and this was only a small sampling, but during the inauguration, I was very surprised, and this is something that's in the new book, the little memoir about the account of the whole inaugural process. And I only mentioned it a little bit, but it was a little deeper than I mentioned in it, because I didn't quite have the words to put to it. But the idea, you know, I met a lot of celebrities. I met people like Eva Longoria. I met people like Beyonce. I met people like Kelly Clarkson. I met James Taylor, the love of my life, you know. And I've always had like a little disdain for things that were too pop or too sort of popular. And I always thought, oh, you know, this is just, you know, bubble gum or whatnot. I realized that most of those people have integrated, and that their real success is that they've never let go of that center of power, of their real vision of who they are and what they want to be in their lives. And that they are not like, it's not just talent. I mean, it is a real synthesis of who they are, and they're not compromising in that sense. They're not flighty in that sense. They understand what they want to do with their art, and it was a lesson for me. I mean, it was a real big lesson that I realized that at the end of the day, those people that in the end of the day touch our hearts and live on popularly or in our consciousness or whatever, you know, whether it be a director of a film or something, people that all honestly have integrated their hearts, souls, and minds and their talent to boot, you know. And I certainly learned that. It was just a small glimpse of it, but I learned that, man, these folks are not who they are just simply because Beyonce can sing. There's an integrity about her persona that meant something. And like that with James Taylor, for example, and even the President of the United States. Like when I met him in May, you realize there was an integrity there that existed. And by golly, if I don't think that's one of the sort of key, I don't want to say secrets because that's a dumb word, but one of the key sort of learning curves in our lives is that integrity, that learning to combine heart, soul, and mind together into one thing so that you're acting, behaving, thinking in a way that's consistent. Again, not 100% and perfect all the time. We all make mistakes. But the idea that we're doing it, I guess, for a higher reason, than it's not just to fulfill the ego. It's not just to be number one pop star. It's not just to be number one poet. It's not just to be number one radio show. But that there's a calling, there's a purpose of something larger. And I see that if you think about even you know, pop icons like actors that really make it, they're doing it because they love it. You know, I think that's what really is the key, just to remember that love, that childlike state of being enamored with what you do, goes a long, long way. And that innocence, getting back to that integral child who you are, you know, that understood the world perfectly till everything came along and confused the hell out of you.
Richard, I just think you're I don't know, you're a special fellow. You didn't get that request to be the inaugural poet by chance, I'll tell you what. I just love the way you can put words together with feelings. It's just so beautiful. So you got about 10 minutes. How long do you need to read what you're going to read?
Well, this is a longish poem, but maybe I'll read, let me see if
long,
I can.
You've got to the top of the hour, okay?
Okay. So, this should be about 7 minutes, so
okay.
We'll do that. This is, unlike the inaugural poem, though I realize the inaugural poem was very, a very personal poem, it just wasn't cast in the first person, I this, I that. But this is the title poem of the latest book of poetry, not the memoir that came out, which tells another story about the inauguration. But this is still, in my mind, still one of my favorite poems. And it speaks about, in some ways, about our place in the world, but it's also about memory, it's about loss, it's about understanding and accepting and still being sad about it, but accepting that sense of our impermanence in the world, but also how beautiful that is, you know, how beautiful it is to be human, that we do have a limited life, you know, a limited physical life, at least in this world, and that every moment counts, and how we can go back and just travel through time and poetry and in our minds, and how beautiful that can be. So it's called Looking for the Gulf Motel. And what happened was I took my partner, Mark, back to Marco Island, a place that we, my parents and I, used to vacation quite a bit when we were kids. And it was a very sort of small little island on the west coast of Florida, on the other side of Miami. And we, it's just one of those special places in your life. And everybody, as I've been reading this poem throughout the country, everybody seems to have their own little Gulf Motel, whether that's an actual motel or just a special place or moment or landscape in their life, that we always know that everything was exactly right.
Just,
and it goes like this.
I'm going to cry on this poem. I know.
As I always say with poets, it's one of the few jobs, and when people say that, you say thank you.
Okay.
I cry too. It's really weird because, like, with poetry, it's like a song. It's like the first time I ever read it or sang it.
I was listening to you do an interview today about that poem right there, and gosh, it took me on this road, and I was like, oh my God, how do you even think of those things to think about?
Yeah,
anyway, go ahead and share it. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Like, that intuitive spirit of the artist is what you're really reaching into. Unbeknownst to even myself at some times, but as I've realized, the poem has kept on teaching me. And as I've read it more and more, people come back to me with this, I remember this in my life, I remember this place, I remember this moment. And you realize that you were channeling into that fundamental sort of human experience of loss, of great memory, of hope, of just beauty. And it's all in its fleeting nature. So, Looking for the Gulf Motel. I should preface one more thing. I went back and took Mark 20 years since I had been there, and I was appalled. And this is how this poem came through, because everything had changed so drastically. Looking for the Gulf Motel. There should be nothing here I don't remember. The Gulf Motel with mermaid lampposts and ship's wheel in the lobby should still be rising out of the sand like a cake decoration. My brother and I should still be pretending we don't know our parents, embarrassing us, as they roll the luggage cart past the front desk, loaded with our scruffy suitcases, 2 dozen loaves of Cuban bread, brown bags bulging with enough mangoes to last the entire week, our espresso pod, the pressure cooker, and a pork roast reeking garlic through the marble lobby. All because we can't afford to eat out, mijo. Not even on vacation. Only 2 hours from our home in Miami, but far enough away to be thrilled by the whiter sands on the west coast of Florida, where I should still be for the first time watching the sun set instead of rise over the ocean. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My mother should still be in the kitchenette of the Gulf Motel, her daisy sandals from Kmart squeaking across the linoleum, still gorgeous in her teal swimsuit and amber earrings, stirring a pot of arroz con pollo, adding sprinkles of onion powder and dollops of tomato sauce. My father should still be in a terry cloth jacket, smoking, clinking a glass of amber whiskey in the amber sunset at the Gulf Motel, watching us dive into the pool, 2 sons he'll never see grow into men who will be proud of him. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My brother and I should still be playing Parcheesi. My father should still be alive, slow dancing with my mother on the sliding glass balcony of the Gulf Motel. Oh, no music, only the waves keeping time, of song, only their minds hear 10,000 nights back to their life in Cuba. My mother's face should still be resting against his bare chest, like the moon resting on the sea and the stars. Oh, the stars should still be turning around them. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My brother should still be 13, sneaking rum in the bathroom, sculpting naked women from sand. And I should still be 8 years old, dazzled by seashells and how many seconds I can hold my breath underwater. But I'm not. I'm 38, driving up Collier Boulevard, looking for the Gulf Motel, for everything that should still be, but isn't. I want to blame the condos, their shadows for ruining the beach and my past. I want to chase the snowbirds away with their tacky McMansions and yachts. I want to turn the golf courses back into mangroves. I want to find the Gulf Motel exactly as it was and pretend for just a moment that nothing I've lost is lost.
I don't want to interrupt you. Are you done? Oh, gosh. Your turn. Sorry.
That's
tear streaming down my eyes.
That's the one place that lives in our consciousness, in our memories, in our lives, in our souls, I think, forever. And that sort of perfect moment that we recognize, even as children, when you realize everything is as it should be, and the things that I think, as we get to adulthood, we sometimes forget, you know, forget to see those moments around us.
It brought so many things. I mean, not just the poetry, but things that my kids right now, my little boy, I embarrass him because I'm there.
Right.
And it, I don't know, it just moved my soul to make me more understanding of being tolerant of my little boy being embarrassed by me. And you're making a difference in ways you probably don't even know you're making a difference.
Right, right.
Thank you.
And that's really the magic of art. Right? In my personal work, that's what I strive for, but also the works that I see with others. I have this idea that the poem is really a mirror. Any art, I think, when done, when it transcends itself, you saw how personal that story was, right?
But yeah, it was
there was
beautiful.
Also this idea that I'm offering up my life as an archetype for some deeper understanding about who we all are. And I've come to think of the poem in its best circumstance to be this mirror where I'm standing in front of the poem, but also the reader is standing in front of the poem, and our lives become blurred, and we're really just one. And the words in the end of the day become irrelevant because it's really what's in between the words in some ways.
You took me on vacation with my family.
That energy you impart when you're writing the poem is what's really coming through. And I think that happens with all art in its best circumstances, why we have a visceral response to something that, in the end of the day, you know, you may have never been to Marco Island ever.
I did tonight.
You've been to some place like Marco Island, right? Like,
you took me to Panama City, Florida. You really did. A specific summer, you took me there. I hadn't thought about that summer in decades. Thank you. You know, and it didn't have to be Panama City. It could have been Gatlinburg, Tennessee, but you took me on a vacation with my family. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad I was able to do that. And it's really interesting because when I wrote the first draft of that poem, it was a really angry poem. And it was about, like, how dare they do this? And I realized that, you know, the real emotional core, soulful emotion that was really at hand was not anger, because anger at the end of the day is just a sign for something else that's bothering us. And it was really about that sense of loss, of that perfection, of that moment, that beauty, and our inability to, we can access it through memory, but we can't, you know, it slips through our fingers every single time. And again, mm-hmm. In some ways, that's what's beautiful about being human, you know, that idea that we get to savor these moments and they slip through our hands, but that makes them all the more precious, you know.
Well, thank you, Richard, so much for opening my eyes to a new world. I've never, ever known this was something that existed until I read your book. Thank you for all of us one day. Please, we've come to the end of the hour, but please tell us again how to find your site so people can have maybe an experience like mine, a wonderful one. What, tell me your website again, please, where to find you.
Yeah, yeah, sure. It's www.richardblanco.com. Lots of great things to look on that site, including a lot of videos and just a lot of more conversations in terms of things that I've come across that I try to put on there. There's also a part of the website that I'm trying to develop in the spirit of the inauguration and one today, of how poetry is making a difference in our lives and perhaps your own experience, as you said, Eva, you know, like this is what I'm trying to continue to let people understand, that poetry is not only, it's not just in a high school English class, that it's something that's happening, it's something that's accessible, it's something that's doing work, it's something that's working towards social justice, it's something, so I'm trying to highlight people and different poets that are doing amazing work in my eyes, but also sort of making a difference in the world in the way that we all can, just doing it through poetry. So I invite people to look on there if you want to know the whole story of the inauguration, including some of the gossip. That's the latest book, which is for all of us, One Today, An Inaugural Poet's Journey. And I invite everyone to please, as your experience, Eva, you know, that to give poetry a chance, contemporary work, and explore it. And it's okay to not, you don't have to love every poem you read or every poet you read. It's just like you don't have to love every movie you see, and you don't have to love every novel you read. But that there's a lot of poets out there that are writing pretty amazing, soulful, cutting-edge sort of stuff that's moving the world in very wonderful ways. And I invite everyone to give it a chance and explore some of that as we move further and further into what is, I'm thinking, a better and better world, hopefully.
Thank you, Richard. And thank you for taking the time to be with me tonight.
Eva,
I really do
absolutely
appreciate your time.
Phenomenal. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.